off last time. John chapter 5. Beginning in verse 1, we'll read our text and then we'll dive in. John 5 and verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, which is called in Hebrew Bethesda, having five porches. In these lay a great multitude of sick people, blind, lame, paralyzed, waiting for the moving of the water. For an angel went down at a certain time into the pool and stirred up the water. Then whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was made well of whatever disease he had. Now a certain man was there who had an infirmity 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he already had been in that condition a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be made well?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no man to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up, but while I am coming, another steps down before me." Jesus said to him, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." And immediately the man was made well and took up his bed and walked. And this is about where we left off last week. And that day was the Sabbath. The Jews therefore said to him who was cured, "It is the Sabbath. It is not lawful for you to carry your bed." He answered them, "He who made me well said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" Then they asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" But the one who was healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, a multitude being in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you have been made well. Sin no more, lest the worst thing come upon you." The man departed and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had made him well. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus and sought to kill him, because he had done these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father has been working until now, and I have been working." Therefore the Jews sought all the more to kill him, because he not only broke the Sabbath, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. Then Jesus answered and said to them, "Most assuredly I say to you, the Son can do nothing of himself but what he sees the Father do. For whatever he does, the Son does in like manner. For the Father loves the Son and shows him all things that he himself does, and he will show him greater works than these that you may marvel. For as the Father raises the dead and gives life to them, even so the Son gives life to whom he will. For the Father judges no one, but has committed all judgment to the Son, that all should honor the Son just as they honor the Father. He who does not honor the Son does not honor the Father who sent him." All right, so that's our text. The discussion regarding the Father and the Son, the relationship continues, but I think if we just go through verse 23, we get enough of what's going on to draw the proper conclusions about the passage. So we've been talking about the seven signs in John. We've already discussed John 2, verses 1 to 12, the turning of the water into wine in Cana of Galilee. Jesus is the master of quality, the life, in the greatest of senses of the party. We talked about the healing of the nobleman's son, John 4, 46 to 54, where Jesus is master over distance and space, and also he is the long-distance operator. And then John 5, so far, we're seeing Jesus as master over disease, and also he is the hope of the hopeless. We'll say more about that as we go along, but seven signs, and as we've been stating, this is why we're studying these signs. This is why they're important. John 20, verse 30 and 31 will be burned into your mind, I hope, where John records for us, "And truly Jesus did many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written." Why are they written, John? "That you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name." So why did John record what he did? So we might believe, that we might see the evidence and draw the proper conclusion and become followers of Christ. So again, this week, as was the case last week, we're talking about the healing of the lame man, Jesus being the hope of the hopeless. Certainly this was a man who had been infirm for a long time and was in need of some solution, and it looked like there was nothing. But Jesus comes on the scene and shows that he brings hope when it seems like there's no hope to be found. Just reviewing a little bit about what we saw last week, the first three verses describes the scene with all of the sick people who were surrounding the pool. And we talked a little bit about why in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when we study the life of Christ, why is it that so often we run into Jesus dealing with people who have physical maladies? Why did he spend so much time with those people? Why did he perform the signs that he did, the healings that he did, for their sake? Does anybody remember? I know you've all slept since then. Okay, that's certainly true. Certainly true. Okay, the confirmation of who he was. Remember we talked a little bit about his messianic mission last week from Isaiah 35. And the prophecy is that when the Messiah would come, he would be a healer. And the healing of those diseases, which symbolized the effect of sin entering the world, would show his ability not only to remedy physical disease, but most importantly, to remedy the sin problem, which because of it, sin and death are now in the world. So the messianic mission of Jesus demanded that for him to fulfill prophecy, he would need to do these kinds of things. And also it shows us a little bit about the love and compassion of God, and we understand that, but primarily it was a matter of confirmation that indeed he was who he said he was. We talked a little bit about the stirring of the water and some of the ideas surrounding that, whether or not that water had any medicinal properties or miraculous properties is really up for debate. Whatever the case, people seemed to believe that that was true and they were waiting. But when we think of the pool of Bethesda, which supposedly could provide what this man couldn't receive, Jesus comes along and he shows that he doesn't need a pool like this. He doesn't need an angel to do what the man requires for healing and for wholeness. And so he heals him. So we have the stirring of the water. We talked a little bit about its place in Scripture and how it arrived there as it did. We look at the sick man, this man who was infirmed. We talked a little bit about his circumstances. And we talked a little bit about why Jesus... What was that? Oh, it's a door. Oh, I thought it was the microphone. Kind of scared me a little bit. Talked about the sick man a little bit and why he may have been chosen. Why did Jesus choose him? And we're not going to go into all of it. Most seem to think that he could read the man's heart. And life is an open book, and he knew that this man had the character to respond to the challenge of faith. Could have been a number of reasons. Certainly compassion played a role. Maybe he was the worst of the worst there. You know, who knows? But he did choose him out of all of the lame people, all the blind people, all the deaf people, all of the folks who were surrounding that pool. For whatever reason, Jesus locked in on him, and he chose him. Now, here's where we stopped last week. The Sabbath day. The Sabbath day. If you look down at verse 11, or actually, let's drop back to verse 9. Jesus tells a man when he perceives that he has the necessary faith to be saved, or at least he's desirous of healing, he says, "Rise, take up your bed and walk." That's verse 8. And he does. And the end of verse 8 there says, "And that day was the what? The Sabbath day." So this is where we want to camp out for a little bit. We started a week ago, but I think it's important that we look at it and clarify it and see what's going on here. So often Jesus did this kind of thing, healing, on the Sabbath day. I can think of several instances. What's that? The Sabbath day would be seventh day, Saturday. Okay. The Jews were very strict about Sabbath day activity, and we can understand why, can't we? The command itself found several places. Exodus 20, verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the rest of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work. You, nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor your stranger who is within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea, and all that is in them, and rested the seventh day. Therefore, the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. So there's the command. If we turn a few chapters over, keep your place marked at John 5. We looked at it a week ago. We'll look at it again. Exodus chapter 31. Beginning in verse 12, says primarily, basically, what we saw in Exodus 20, but Exodus chapter 31 in verse 12, beginning. And what we need to understand when we study this, or the reaffirming of the covenant where the Ten Commandments are given in Deuteronomy 5, or if we look at the book of Nehemiah in chapter 9, the Sabbath day rest, hear me very closely, was never given to New Testament Christians. Okay, the Sabbath day rest was given to the Jews, just as the Ten Commandments were. That was their national law. Okay, think of Judaism as a country. Think of leaving that country and going to a new territory and establishing a new nation. That would be the New Testament. Although you certainly may have the same ideas within the fabric of your new national law, it's not the same, is it? You've left behind that old country for something new. Now, in this dispensation, on this side of the cross, we certainly appreciate the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament. They were written for our learning. But at the same time, when we seek to find out what pleases God in this era, what are we supposed to do? We go to the New Testament because that is our guide. That is our law. And we say all that not to leave the impression that the Old Testament is not important. It's extremely important. Extremely valuable. You cannot understand the New Testament as you should if you don't study your Old Testament. Because it all leads to its culmination in the new law, the gospel. But the Sabbath rest was given to the Israelites as a reminder that God had brought them out of Egypt by His mighty power. Read that in Deuteronomy 5. God didn't bring us out of Egypt. He saved us from our sins, but again, this was a national law. This Sabbath rest looked forward to another rest that remains, which is heaven itself. That's a whole other story. I tried to stay away from that and just pass it on by, but I couldn't help myself. All right? So, we look at Exodus 31, right? Something happened here. There we go. Exodus 31, beginning in verse 12, and this is what Moses records for us. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak also to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep, for it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." He's writing to the Israelites. "You shall keep the Sabbaths, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it or treats it as a common day shall surely be put to death." That's pretty serious, isn't it? "For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath to observe the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the children of Israel forever." You see that? That's really, really important. "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. And when he had made an end of this speaking with him on Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the two tablets of testimony, the tablets of stone written with the finger of God." What is that? That is the Ten Commandments, right? Given to the Israelites. Now, Jesus was a Jew, right? Living under the Old Testament economy. He was bound by the Sabbath law because he was one of the children of Israel, physical and spiritual for that matter, but he had physical ties back to Abraham. So we see its importance. Now, we won't look at this passage, but here's what we find in Nehemiah 13, just briefly. I'll just bring it up. What we find in Exodus and Deuteronomy 5 is this. Keep the Sabbath, do no work. Okay? What constitutes work? That's where it gets hairy. What constitutes work? Now, evidently, you're saying, preacher, you'll never know because that's your preacher. But anyway, Nehemiah 9, evidently, to buy and sell, to open the gates of Jerusalem and to act like it was any other day, and to put your merchandise out and try to sell and to trade and to barter, that's work. Nehemiah said, you don't do that. You're not going to carry on like every other day when you go about your business to make your ends meet. That is work. That's what we got. Okay? Now, we won't read these quotes again, but what I want us to do is I want us to think about this idea regarding the Sabbath day and Jesus healing the man. Okay? What constitutes work? If you study the Old Testament, the Torah, the Jews, the rabbis, through the years had written commentaries on the books. They sought to explain all the various laws. There was the Mishnah and the Gemara, which are, again, these commentaries of the law. It would be like anybody today taking the New Testament and explaining it all, and then over time, what the passages mean begin to be codified and become orthodox. And there have been times perhaps when this kind of thing takes place and the comments made by the interpreters becomes law, even when what they're saying may not be accurate in comparison to the law itself. The Jews had at least 30 activities that they wrote down that said this violates the Sabbath day. Okay, now who's determining this? Okay, they are. Now understand, all of us have to come to the Bible with an open mind, try to discern how do we make application of this? But here's the problem. When Jesus healed the man who had been infirm for 38 years, when he told him to rise up and take his bed and walk, arise, take up his bed and walk, that was one of those 30 or so things that the rabbis had determined constituted work. Think Jesus knew that? He did know that. He did know that. Think he agreed with it? Evidently he did. But the Jewish leadership of his day looked at this and they said, okay, this man has been healed on the Sabbath day. Another one of these things that had been put in place regarding the Sabbath day was as it pertains to medical health. Okay? Other than something that was considered major that had to be taken care of immediately, the Jews expected those who were ill, if you're going to go to a doctor, you need to go on a day other than the Sabbath. Now, if you're in the field and you cut yourself and it looks like you're going to bleed to death, fine, you can be taken care of. But if you have a cold or a fever, you're going to have to wait until Sunday, the first day of the week, before you go and get anything done about it. Think about that for a second, okay? So they had all of these laws that they had ascribed to the Sabbath day, although the Sabbath day just simply says, remember the Sabbath day, keep it holy, do no work. All right? Okay, Roy. It's okay. Okay, well, maybe it's, I don't know if that's, I don't think our doctors aren't working on Sunday because they believe in a Christian Sabbath that some people have heard that. Thank you. We always need a little comic relief, and we appreciate it. Well, here's what we need to remember, all right? Look at these passages with me. We're going somewhere. There's some method to this madness here. We're going somewhere. Jesus is being accused of breaking the Sabbath day. In fact, the text says he broke the Sabbath. Or at least that's the way they viewed it. Okay, that's the way they viewed it. But let's think about these passages. Turn to 2 Corinthians 5. Some of you don't even need to because you've lived in that chapter most of your life. But 2 Corinthians 5. And we'll read them together. I want you to kind of meditate and let it roll around in your minds as we do and think about the implications of the passages that we're going to know. We'll start in verse 20, 2 Corinthians 5, and we'll read verse 21 on the heels of it. 2 Corinthians 5:20 says, "Now then, we are ambassadors for Christ, as though God were pleading through us. We implore you on Christ's behalf, be reconciled to God." In other words, let God save you. Come to Him on His terms, because the Corinthians were slipping. But notice what he says. He's talking about what the Father did in relationship to Jesus. For He, the Father, made Him Christ. And what does the next phrase say? Who knew no sin to become sin for us? That we might be made, the Bible says, the righteousness of God through Him. Okay, so in some sense, in order for you and I to be right with God, Jesus had to be sinlessly perfect. You with me on that? All right? Let's look at Hebrews 4 and verse 15. Again, to really emphasize the idea, Hebrews 4 and verse 15. Jesus is our high priest, meaning he's the one that we go through to reach God, the most holy place. And the text says in Hebrews 4 and verse 15 that we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin. All right? A few chapters over here, 2 Peter 2, verse 22. 2 Peter 2, 22. For to this you were called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow in His steps. Verse 22 says, who committed no sin, nor was guile or deceit found in his mouth. There it is again. Who committed no sin, nor was guile. What? I did this last time. I've never even read 2 Peter 2. I don't know why. 2 Peter 2 is about false teachers who have come in, crept unaware among us. That's right. I hate it. That disgusts me. 1 Peter 2, 22. Who committed no sin, nor was any guile found in him. Even when he suffered, he acted accordingly, correct? And I think the last passage is 1 John 3:5. But we'll start in verse 4. 1 John 3:4. Whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness or transgression. And sin is lawlessness, or sin is a transgression of the law. Notice verse 5. And you know that He, Jesus, was manifested to take away our sins. And in Him there is no sin. All right? Now let's think back to what's being said here in our text of John 5. Let's think of what's being said here in John 5. Jesus heals a man on the Sabbath day. Tells him to do something that the rabbis had determined constitutes work. They accuse him of breaking the Sabbath law. The question is, did he? And if he didn't, how do we know? what would breaking the Sabbath law constitute? Sin. But Jesus committed no sin. Therefore, we conclude, logically so, he did not break the Sabbath. Therefore, what did he break? We could say nothing, but what did he violate? He violated their traditions as it related to the Sabbath day. You see, it was never improper to do good on the Sabbath day. In other words, it was never wrong to show compassion. It was never wrong to aid someone. In fact, you know, you read Luke's account, he talks about, you know, he healed a certain individual on one occasion who had been infirm for quite some time, and there was great consternation about it. And remember, he asked questions like, which of you, if your ox falls in a ditch, won't pull him out on the Sabbath day? They all knew they would do that. And so in essence, they were saying an ox or a donkey was more valuable than a human being. And Jesus said, you have absolutely missed the import of the Sabbath. You've missed it. Yes, sir. Yeah. Absolutely. And like in Mark 7, you know, the Jews had concocted this idea of korban. What does the Bible say to the Jews? And the principle hangs on for us as well. Honor your father and your mother that you may live long in the land, right? Well, by the time of Jesus' day, the religious leaders were saying, it's okay to take that money that you should be giving to your father and your mother, and you can give it to the temple. And you can say korban. It's for God. And Jesus, he just lambasted them about that. He said, you have made null the word of God by your tradition. So here again, we see them steeped in their tradition where they had, you know, that's why Jesus said, even when he was accused of violating the Sabbath in other places, he would say, go and see what this means. I desire mercy rather than sacrifice. Does that mean he never wants sacrifice? No. What the Jews had determined constituted work, as God saw it, was not work. And also, there was certain types of activities that you can say is work, but it's not Sabbath-violating work. How do you know that, Bill? Notice verses 16 through 23. We're just about done. They were seeking to kill Jesus, right? Once they realized who it was that had healed this man and in turn urged him to break the Sabbath as well, they want to kill Jesus. They're ready to put him to death. So seeking to kill, verses 16 through 23. Notice this statement here. Something's missing. No, it's not. This is what they say, or what the text records for us. For this reason, the Jews persecuted Jesus. They believed he had broken the Sabbath and sought to kill him. Because he'd done these things on the Sabbath, but Jesus answered them, my Father has been working until now, and I have been working. Therefore, the Jews sought all the more to kill him. Notice this, because he not only broke the Sabbath, or at least that's the way they viewed it, but also said that God was his Father, making himself equal with God. And we see this all throughout John, don't we? Before Abraham was what? I am. They wanted to kill him then because they knew what he was saying. And now he's saying, evidently not all work is inappropriate because the Father works every day and I work every day. What kind of work is done? Providential care of all things. Jesus comes on the scene. He has a ministry. His work was to take place until they finally killed him and put him on a cross. And then it was finished. Did that violate the Sabbath in a way that broke it? No. What if the Sabbath day, what if a child was born and the day that came along, the eighth day for circumcision, landed on the Sabbath? What were they supposed to do? What were the priests supposed to do? Circumcise the child. But it's the Sabbath day. Doesn't matter. That doesn't violate it. That's not the kind of thing that the Lord had in mind when he gave the command. You're not to go out and try to make your ends meet, is what he said. You're not to go out and try to do the normal things you would do for the upholding of your lifestyle. That's work. But to show compassion, to do what's absolutely necessary. And think about this poor man. That cot, what did he do on that cot every day? He slept on it. Jesus says, take up your bed and walk. What were his options if what the Jews said was true about the Sabbath? He could leave that bed there and go home. Then where's he going to sleep? Or he could sit there until the next day. But neither one of those things, to take his bed and go home, which was absolutely necessary, was not a violation of the Sabbath law. Even though the Jews had determined that it was. The leadership had determined that it was. Here's what we find, verses 16 to 18. When Jesus says, I have been working until now, my Father has been working. The saying was tantamount to Jesus equating himself with God. The Old Testament was clear that God rested on the Sabbath after creating the universe. Yet Jewish theologians believe God's providence continued to govern the world even on the Sabbath day. God's still working. This was confirmed by the fact that people continued to be born and die on the Sabbath. Consequently, the belief developed that God exercised two prerogatives on the Sabbath. He gave life and he executed judgment. So only God could work on the Sabbath. And Jesus' claim in verse 17 to also work on the Sabbath by healing the paralytic made him equal to God. With this blasphemous assertion, Jesus' critics began to harbor the notion to kill him. They got it. And think about this. This is just wrap your head around this for a second. If Jesus had healed a man, which everybody would have seen, probably known about, one of the things you find when you study the gospel accounts and Acts, usually the people that are healed, just about everybody knows who they are, right? I mean, they've got some idea who they are. If Jesus demonstrates the power to heal a man who had been lame for 38 years on the Sabbath day, what might that say about him and his understanding of Sabbath law? He has that power. And that ability, which could have only been given to him by who? By God. Wouldn't that then imply that this man must understand something about the Sabbath that we don't? I would think so. And notice, here's what you would think would happen. Imagine if one of our members here had been lame for 38 years and had laid up here on this bench just hoping and praying that one day something might happen where healing might come. All right? And let's just say that the Lord would walk through our doors. We don't know it's the Lord, but he sits down and he stands up at the end of service and says, by the way, stand up and walk, and this guy gets up and walks. We all know this guy. Okay? What are we going to focus on immediately? This guy was healed. Do you see what's happened? Something great has happened here. Something beyond our wildest imaginations. We need to hear what this guy has to say. See who he is. And isn't it great? This man's now healed. Our friend is healed. Our brother is healed. But what are the Jews concerned about? Here's a man holding his bed who's been lame 38 years. And all they can think about is what? What does that say about them? Where's the compassion? We are so glad you're healed. Tell us who this was, because, you know, something must be amiss in our understanding. Not so. No wonder Jesus just absolutely rebuked them so often about their hardness of heart. All right, so here's our conclusion. Here's what I think we can draw from this. From the healing of the lame man, Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God. That's apparent. That's what that sign was to demonstrate. If he is, and he is, as the Messiah, the Son of God, he is Lord of the Sabbath. He refers to himself in that way. He's Lord of the Sabbath. If anybody knows how the Sabbath is to be honored, it's him, not these religious leaders of his day. Therefore, he understood the Sabbath law parameters and never violated them. Again, who committed no sin, nor was any guile found in his mouth. Notice this. When I put 1 Peter 2:22 up here this time, it's right. All right? Notice that. The religious leaders of Jesus' day erred in their traditions regarding the Sabbath law. Matthew 23:4, he rebukes them for that very reason. It was never wrong to show compassion or take care of pressing needs on the Sabbath day. All of the laws the Jews conjured up about it generally were their own devising and not what God ever intended. Anyway, that's it. It's time to quit.
Interesting, Bill, that he had
true. And Paul says in Galatians 5:11, he said, if I still preach circumcision, why am I